Time and Religion. Excellent education. I have a very broad background in liberal arts.
We must also realize that the problems of racial injustice and economic injustice cannot be solved without a radical redistribution of political and economic power.
We read one day, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. But if a man doesn't have a job or an income, he has neither life nor liberty and the possibility for the pursuit of happiness. He merely exists. Estimated that we spend $322,000 for each enemy we kill in Vietnam, while we spend in the so-called war on poverty in America only about $53 for each person classified as poor. The promises of the Great Society have been shut down on the battlefield of Vietnam, making the poor, white and Negro, bear the heaviest burdens both at the front and at home.
The other thing I want you to understand is this, that it didn't cost the nation one penny to integrate lunch counts. It didn't cost the nation one penny to guarantee the right to vote. But now we are dealing with issues that cannot be solved without the nation spending billions of dollars and undergoing a radical redistribution of economic power.
Yes.
All labor has dignity.
Yes.
But you are doing another thing. You are reminding not only Memphis, but you are reminding the nation that it is a crime for people to live in this rich nation and receive starvation wages.
America's opportunity to help bridge the gulf between the haves and the have-nots. And the question is whether America will do it. There's nothing new about poverty. What is new is that we now have the techniques and the resources to get rid of poverty. And the real question is whether we have the will.
At the very same time that America refused to give the Negro any land, through an act of Congress, our government was giving away millions of acres of land in the West and the Midwest, which meant that it was willing to undergird its white peasants from Europe with an economic floor. But not only did they give the land, they built land-grant colleges with government money to teach them how to farm. Not only that, they provided county agents to further their expertise in farming. Not only that, they provided low interest rates in order that they could mechanize their farms. Not only that, today many of these people are receiving millions of dollars in federal subsidies not to farm, and they are the very people telling the black man that he ought to lift himself by his own bootstraps. Now, this is what we are faced with, and this is the reality. Now, when we come to Washington in this campaign, we are coming to get our check.
I come here tonight and plead with you. Believe in yourself and believe that you're somebody. As I said to a group last night, Nobody else can do this for us. No document can do this for us. No Lincolnian Emancipation Proclamation can do this for us. No Kennisonian or Johnsonian Civil Rights Bill can do this for us. If the Negro is to be free, he must move down into the inner resources of his own soul and sign with the pen and ink of self-assertive manhood his own Emancipation Proclamation. Don't let anybody take your...
We are tonight talking about crossing with our ancestors. We bring in Coretta Scott King, Dr. King's wife, and she was over the King Center down in Atlanta about 15 years, and we're going to bring her on tonight. And we're still saying God have the answer for you, and God have the solution for you, and God have something to do for you. And when you get ready for God to bless you, he will bless you. God is available for you if you're available for him. And all this week, going into Black History Week, we're going to start off with Coretta Scott King, Dr. King with her, the one that was with Dr. King in Boston, down in Mississippi, in Arkansas. And we're going to hear from her as she began to talk.
Well, first of all, I was extremely excited and about what was going on, because this was something that had never happened before. And I knew this was history-making. And I also knew that it was not only happening in Montgomery, but it was, the impact of this was really much further, much more extensive than Montgomery, because during the Montgomery boycott, we heard that there was a boycott in Johannesburg, South Africa, of buses, and also there was one in Mobile and in Tallahassee, so it was like it was spreading. But we also knew that the struggle was much bigger than a boycott. It was about the injustices in our society. It was about changing the society in such a way and changing the laws of the government locally, and certainly nationally we had to create new laws to protect us and protect the rights once they were won. And we even experienced what was like modern day miracles when things happened, like when the Supreme Court had ruled on bus desegregation. We were in court that day because, excuse me, the city of Montgomery was having a hearing and was trying to outlaw our transportation system. And if it had, maybe the people would have gotten tired and gone back to the buses. And my husband was very worried. And I said to him, you know what? I think that by the time we go to court and by the time the judge rules, that the Supreme Court will have ruled. And we felt that if the Supreme Court ruled, it would be in our favor. And that was my consolation. And sure enough, while we were in court, Associated Press, an Associated Press reporter handed a note to my husband, and it said, the Supreme Court of the United States has ruled today that bus segregation in Montgomery.
This is Coretta Scott King, Dr. King Woodrow. She's telling about what happened in the movement when it got started in 1997 and throughout the movement in Mississippi, Alabama. So you need to listen to this going into Black History Week, because God was involved in all that happened in Arkansas and Mississippi. People was murdered. People was killed. But Dr. King and Coretta, husband and wife, and God gave them the mountain. And she telling, after her husband died, she is a strong black woman and a woman of God. And tonight we are praying for you as we cross over Ashe, our ancestors. One lady called me and asked me about her son. And I want to tell you up in California that your son was murdered and it's going to all come out. And tonight we're crossing over our ancestors. We got Coretta Scott King, Dr. Martin Luther King Wooder, giving us
the Constitution. So that ended the court session. So it was that kind of thing, or an intervention again, that helped us to realize that we were doing the right thing, and you continue to do that. And that, more importantly, that I had been called personally to be in Montgomery at that time because I had always sought my purpose. As a teenager, I began to think about what my life was going to be like. And going to college, that was one level. Going beyond there was the next level, going to prepare for a music career. But when I got to Boston, I realized another reason for me being there. And then I wondered why Martin Luther King Jr., a minister that I didn't think I would ever marry, a minister, and then he was going back south. I wanted to go back south, but I wasn't prepared to go at that time because I had to finish my work. And finally, in Montgomery, and then things began to happen, and the house was bombed. So I did a lot of soul searching after that and tried to remember, you know, try to think back of how I got there. And I realized that all my life I had been being prepared for this role and that we were supposed to be there in Montgomery. And it was a great feeling of satisfaction because I realized that I had found my purpose.
That's cool. Talk about what happened down south and what happened with her and Dr. King. Young couple, just started a family, and it's something for black women and black men to understand together.
I realized when Montgomery started that this was probably the reason we were called to Montgomery. After my house was bombed and, of course, all the threats on my husband's life, on my life too, I realized I could have been killed as well because I was in the house when the bomb hit the front porch with my young baby. And the callers had been calling, and they said that they were going to bomb my house, told my husband they were going to bomb his house and kill his family if he didn't leave town in 3 days. Of course, he didn't leave town in 3 days, and they did bomb the house. So knowing that they meant what they said, because they actually did bomb the house, that the bomb was not strong enough to destroy the house. But if it had been, then, you know, that would have been very, very sad for all of us, certainly for me and my baby and my husband. But the fact is that I had to deal with the fact that if I continued in the struggle, I too could be killed. And that's when I started praying very seriously about my commitment and whether or not I would be able to stick with my husband to continue in the struggle. And, of course, it wasn't that difficult. It was a struggle, but I knew that we were doing the right thing. I always felt that what was happening in Montgomery was part of God's will and purpose. And we were put there to be in the forefront of that struggle. And it wasn't just a struggle relegated to Montgomery, Alabama, the South, but that it had worldwide implications. And I felt really a sense of fulfillment that I hadn't felt before, that this was really what I was supposed to be doing. And it was a great blessing to have discovered this and to be doing what was God's will for your life.
After we were successful in desegregating the buses in Montgomery,
The nonviolent revolution we launched in Montgomery spread like a prairie fire across the southern states. My husband led nonviolent protest campaigns against racism and segregation in cities across the South, as well as in Chicago, Cleveland, and other cities in the North. During this time, I had three more children and participated in movement activities as much as possible. People ask me, how was I able to do this and raise four children at the same time? I can only reply that when God calls you to a great task, He provides you with the strength to accomplish what He has called you to do. Faith and prayer, family and friends were always available when I needed them. And of course, Martin and I always were there for each other. I learned that when you are willing to make sacrifices for a great cause, you will never be alone because you will have divine companionship and the support of good people. This same faith and cosmic companionship sustained me after my husband was assassinated and gave me the strength to make my contribution to carrying forward his unfinished work.
That was Coretta Scott King.
Well,
going
it
to Black
was the belief that we were doing the right thing. Because it had never happened before, it was like, you know, the Supreme Court decision had been rendered in 1954, and this was in 1955. And we were all motivated by that and knowing that this meant the beginning of breaking down the system of segregation. We recognized that if the schools could desegregate, this means that other things can desegregate as well. So with Montgomery happening, it was like an intervention there that God had planted Rosa Parks and also Martin Luther King Jr. And so you had this sense that something very, very significant was happening and that it had would have impact beyond around the world, that we were not only struggling to free the people of the South, but oppressed people around the world. And we had no idea where it was leading, but we had a sense that it was leading to something more, much more significant than what we were involved in at the time. And each time there was things, for instance, the stabbing incident where Martin was stabbed in Harlem. I mean, it's like it made no sense, except that God was preparing us for something even bigger. And then when the Nobel Peace Prize came along, which we were rewarded in a sense for our struggles, it was like, but this is still not it, because we have not achieved the peace that he was awarded, the award represented, but we still have a long way to go. So it was always not knowing what the future held, but we knew that we were on the right path, and you had a sense of, as Martin used to say, cosmic companionship, and that kept you going. When I say I was married to the cause, I was married to my husband, whom I loved. I learned to love. It wasn't love at first sight, but I also became married to the cause. It was my cause, and that's the way I felt about it. And so when my husband was no longer there, then I could continue that in that cause, and I prayed that God would give me the direction for my life, to give me the strength to do what it was and the ability to do what it was that he had called me to do. And I was trying to seek what is it that I'm supposed to do now that Martin's no longer here. And I finally determined that it was to develop an institution. I was already involved in building the institution, but I wasn't sure that that was it. I thought maybe it might have been with women, but then, of course, I didn't get that feeling in particular, but always because I thought there was a need to have more women involved in
organizing them around as a support group to my husband, and I encouraged him to do that. And he didn't do that in particular. And I thought, well, maybe then that might be what I'm supposed to do. But then I finally determined that it was the King Center, because Martin's message and his meaning were so powerful, and his spirit, I felt, needed to be continued. I mean, I know that people's spirit live on, but I think in a very positive, meaningful way that young people would know that that influence was being continued. And so I felt that my role then was to develop an institution, to institutionalize his philosophy, his principles of nonviolence, and his methodology of social change. And that's what I spent my years doing. 27 years I was president, founder, CEO. I'm still the founder. You're never always the founder. But I retired from that position in 1995, and my son Dexter is now in that position. But I still continue to do all the work that I can to reach as many people as I can with the message.
That was Co-Reverend Scott King telling about growing up in Alabama.
I grew up in the Deep South. It was totally segregated in terms of race, and everything was separate but unequal. I had wonderful parents who inspired me to be the best person that I could be. My mother always told me that I was going to go to college, even if she didn't have one dress to put on. And so I grew up knowing that I was going to somehow find a way out of the situation I grew up in. I grew up on a farm. We were culturally deprived, but we were not poor in the sense that we didn't have very much. We had limited resources because in the country at that time, nobody had very much, and we had probably more than most people. As an African-American child growing up in the segregated South, I was told one way or another almost every day of my life that I wasn't as good as a white child. When I went to the movies with other black children, we had to sit in the balcony while the white kids got to sit in the better seats below. We had to walk to school while the white children rode in school buses paid for by our parents' taxes. Such messages saying we were inferior were a daily part of our lives. But I was blessed with parents who taught me not to let anyone make me feel like it wasn't good enough. And as my mother told me, you are just as good as anyone else. You get an education and try to be somebody. Then you won't have to be kicked around by anybody. And you won't have to depend on anyone for your livelihood, not even a man. Well, my parents taught me some wonderful values that have lasted me, have stayed with me, and I've built on them throughout my life. If it had been for my parents, who I consider heroes, I wouldn't be the kind of person I am. I am very thankful and grateful for them. They're both deceased now. But I went to Antioch College in Yellow Springs, Ohio. And Antioch College, as you probably realize, is a college that teaches people how to have a world view. All races were represented at the time, and religions. And an excellent education. I had a very broad background, liberal arts. And I had the work experience as well. And Antioch was about making change in societies, about social change, which was preparing me at that time for the role that I would play later in life. You know, I was inspired by the words of many, many, many persons. And I don't recall right at the moment just which but the words of, I used to recite a lot of poetry, and I was inspired by the words of of Longfellow, lives of great men are reminders. You know, even though I was a female, but you know, back then we didn't think of it as male, female as much, but I thought of it, of course that means me too. You know, lives of great men all remind us we can make our lives sublime and depart and be blind, footprints on the sand of time, and so on. I was inspired by the likes of Mrs. Eleanor Roosevelt because I was in high school during the 40s, and of course President Roosevelt was at that time one of my favorite. He was a hero of mine, and I used to love to hear him speak, and I recognized the voice whenever he came on the radio, because we didn't have televisions back then. And I never got to meet Mrs. Roosevelt, Mrs. Mary McLeod Bethune, a black woman who became an advisor to President Roosevelt and founded a school in Florida, the Bethune-Cookman College, was another great black woman that was a role model for me. My teacher in some high school, and then of course there was Paul Robeson, who was a great singer and had such a commanding presence when I first met him and he performed. You know, you could just feel so much power when he walked out on the stage. And his words were so meaningful. His very deep voice, both speaking and singing. You know, it was the way it was. I didn't like it, and I always felt less. I knew I was important as they were, but it sort of brought down a curtain, you know, in a sense, on my selfhood, and helped me to become more determined to get out of that situation and to try to do something about it when I had an opportunity. So I was determined myself to get an education, to get the best education possible, and to be able to come back and give back something to that community. And that was really what I went to college with my mind on, as well as the New England Conservatory of Music. So I studied elementary education and music in Antioch, and I couldn't get a full music degree, but I always wanted to study music. That was my first love. In high school, I had a teacher who influenced me greatly, Miss Olive J. Williams. And she was versatile in music, and I wanted to be like her. She exposed me to the world of classical music. Before then, I had never heard classical music. She exposed me also to the great composers of the world, and as well as black performers, which I didn't know about at the time, Marian Anderson, Paul Robeson, and Roland Hayes, and Dorothy Maynard, and others. And so I got my foundation and my beginning there. And then at Antioch, I built on that with another teacher named Walter Anderson. And he was the one who eventually encouraged me to apply when I graduated from Antioch to the New England Conservatory of Music in Boston. So I attended the New England Conservatory on a scholarship to Antioch. A scholarship to the conservatory, and of course, after my first semester in Boston in 1951, I met Martin Luther King Jr. And of course, Martin Luther King Jr. was studying for his doctorate in systematic theology, and he was going to go back south and pastor a church, a Baptist church, and he was looking for a wife, and I wasn't looking for a husband, but he was a wonderful human being, and he made everyone feel special, and he made me feel very special, you know, as a woman. But I still resisted his overtures, but after he persisted, I had to pray about it, because I've had my parents were religious. I was brought up in the church, And I had a strong faith. I always believed that there was a purpose for my life and that I had to seek that purpose, and that if I discovered that purpose, then I believed that I would be successful in what I was doing. And I thought I had found that purpose when I decided that music was my was going to be my career, concert singing. I was going to be trained as a concert singer at the New England Conservatory of Music. I studied voice. The first year, and after I met Martin and prayed about whether or not I should open myself to that relationship, I had a dream, and in that dream I was made to feel that I should allow myself to be open and stop fighting the relationship, and that's what I did, and of course the rest is history. I could... I finished conservatory, the degree in voice and music education, and my second instrument was violin. I started doing concerts when I was a college student, and after we moved to Montgomery, my husband was called to church there, I continued to perform. I performed concerts the first year, got pregnant, had to stop, performed between babies. I have four children. I was doing standard concerts. When I had my fourth child, I realized I could not continue to do that that way. And I developed the Freedom Concert concept, where I narrated the story of the civil rights movement that we were involved in, and sang freedom songs in between the narrations that told the story of our struggle from Montgomery to Washington at that time. In 1964, I did my debut with my freedom concert at Town Hall, raised money for the cause, and from the rest of the time, I raised money for my husband's organization doing freedom concerts across the country and so forth. I think what I've tried to do is to empower people to understand that they can make a difference, and by using the method of nonviolence as a way of life, I mean, it becomes internalized into your life. And so everything that you seek to do, you use those principles and those steps, based on those principles and the steps and methodology, so that if you have a problem, a conflict, in whatever it is you're doing, you be able to better resolve that. And if it's dealing with people, you know, certainly you know how to resolve that to become reconciled and to move forward. So today we have many problems that are, some of them are new problems. You have the human rights struggle continuing, but you also have problems like HIV and AIDS, which I think young people have to be dedicated to find ways to deal with these problems, to educate the whole world, because the world as a whole needs education. We have a lot of education that needs to be done here in this country so that people can avoid getting the disease. And, of course, we know that people can live with the disease, but there's a tremendous amount of work that needs to be done there. There are other problems that we're fighting now with the violence. That violence is so pervasive. People have access to guns, and so many people are being killed. I've done a lot of work with the handgun control organization. It's called the Brady Organization now, with Sarah and Jim Brady. There are many things that we can do now to get involved with so many of the causes that are tending to destroy us. And I think that nonviolence allows you to it empowers you to do what is necessary, because what you do is build coalitions. You can't do all of it by yourself, but you can put together coalitions and get other people involved, or join organizations that are already involved and continue to work to eradicate poverty. Of course, poverty is still with us. Very much so. My husband, one of the three triple, the triple evils that he talks about, poverty, racism, and war. And, of course, they all are forms of violence. And we have to continue to work to make sure that people everywhere have a decent livelihood, that they have jobs, they have housing, they have health care, they have quality education, all of these areas that we still have to work on and to improve so that the quality of life for all people is improved and we can achieve indeed the beloved community that Martin talked about that I believe in. No, I never thought that it wasn't the way to go. I guess because of my religious upbringing and, you know, I believe that even though we kind of stray away from it, but you know what is right. I mean, that you have been taught to, it was wrong to kill. I believe that firmly. I believe that you have to try to resolve your conflicts without violence. I believe that you have to give something back to society that has nurtured you. And so I never got to the point where I felt that nonviolence was not viable. I just felt that when there was violence, and it came from within, and very seldom violence did come from within, I realized that it wasn't that it wouldn't work. It's that people didn't follow the proper steps and are trying to achieve it. Because there are a set of principles and there are a set of steps in the methodology that we were taught about nonviolence. And when we follow those, they work. It may take a while. But in order to have a peaceful solution and a lasting peace, it has to be a nonviolent approach.
Samsung S24 Ultra in a mouse case. Here we go.
Well, certainly you have to get the best possible education and training that's available. You have to decide that you need to learn as much about the world and society. And these young people live in a global village, really. Everybody lives in a global village and a global community. I didn't know at the time, I didn't live in the global community, but I had a vision of that I would be living in a global village. I knew I had to be prepared to be comfortable anywhere in the world. That was what my goal was. So these young people are being prepared differently than I was because they live in a different time. But the most important thing they have to decide is not just to do or to get an education and to be selfish about it, but that they must prepare themselves to give back and to make a difference in the world. We have to create what my husband called the beloved community. If we are to survive, we have to learn how to solve our problems and resolve our conflicts in a nonviolent manner. And so I think it's important for them to realize that they have a, and I solicit your continued prayers as we transition to a new season. And again, I want to thank each and every one of you for being here. Thank you, media, for being here today with us. And apologize, it's not in my traditional fashion. Doing the best I can. But I love each and every one of you and appreciate you. And if anyone has any questions, I'll do the best I can. But I got my sides here, so they'll help to protect me. No. I think they want you to do it with the mic just so that, because we are streaming, actually, so the people can hear. Thank you, Marie.
Dr. King. And your brothers, I want to ask you about like the pressure that you and your brothers and sister have had in your life. In his book, he said, his surviving family continues to be attacked for no reason except none of us, his children, turned out to be him. All of us together are him, the part that's left on this earth. Can you just talk about just, you know, the pressure that you and your brothers had to deal with, and particularly with Dexter, when you talked about how the negative publicity he used to get about what he was trying to do to protect your family's image and name?
You know, I'm going to answer this way. My mother was attacked too, by the way. But I'm going to answer this way. She used to always say to us, one, people over and over again are going to try to reassassinate your father. Be strong. Just know that in different ways. We see that in various sundry ways today. An effort even right now, I forget his name, trying to level a campaign against my father in the Civil Rights Act. But it's happening all around in different ways. But what my mother said to us secondly, which was most important, is that you don't have to be me. You don't have to be your father, but be your best self. And I think as these things began to happen, having that in my mind, in the front of Martin's mind, because he talks about best self, has lessened that burden. Doesn't mean it made it easy, but it made it manageable. So thank you for asking that question. It has been difficult, but I know I'm Bernice. I have my own unique gifts and talents and my own place in this legacy. As many people would ask, what is your legacy? I tell them, look, I don't have to discover a legacy. I was born into a legacy. We were born into a legacy. And we each have a defined role to carry forward that legacy.
We honor Dr. Martin Luther King. It's Black History Month. As we go into Black History Month, we just lost Dexter, Dr. King, and he was over the Dr. Martin Luther King Center in Atlanta. But as we focus, stop the killing, save the babies, stop the war in Israel, I'm praying for you and your hope that this tape that you're listening to can help you out and you understand that you have a role to play in the history of life. And once you understand the role that you got to play, you understand the power of Dr. King.
President Berthoff, members of the faculty and members of the student body of this great institution of learning, ladies and gentlemen, I need not pause to say how very delighted and honored I am to have the privilege of coming once more to campus of Illinois Wesleyan, and the privilege of sharing with you in your lecture series. And I certainly want to express my appreciation to you for extending the invitation. I must apologize for being a little late getting here this evening. It so happened that we had a very important meeting in Chicago, and it was raining a little when we left Chicago, and we were moving from the meeting where I had to speak to get to the airport, and my assistant, Reverend Bernard Lee, who's here, was driving us along, and I noticed the car skipping around a bit in the midst of this rather slippery pavement, and I had to say to Bernard to slow up a little bit, and I followed that up by saying I would rather be Martin Luther King late than the late Martin Luther King. But we're here and delighted to be here, And as your distinguished president has said, we are happy to be accompanied by Mrs. King, whom you've already met, and also by my dearest friend and close associate and perennial jailmate, the Reverend Dr. Ralph David Abernathy and his wife, to my left, may stand just on the scene. That is an innocence, a poignant question on the lips of hundreds and thousands, yea, millions of people all over our nation and all over the world. I get it a great deal as I journey around the country and other places, and I'm sure this question is on the lips of many here tonight. It is a question, are we really making any progress in race relations? And I think that are basically three answers that can be given to this question. One is the answer of extreme optimism. Now, the extreme optimist would say in substance that we are making marvelous strides in race relations. They would point joyously to the marvelous developments that have taken place over the last few decades in terms of legislative advances. And from this, they would conclude that the problem is just about solved now and that we can sit down comfortably on the wayside and wait on the coming of the inevitable. The second position that can be taken is that of extreme pessimism. The extreme pessimist would say that we've made only minor strides in race relations. They would contend that the deep rumblings of discontent that we hear over the nation, the resurgence of the Ku Klux Klan in some sections of the South and other sections of the North, the rebirth of white citizens' councils, all indicative of the fact that we have created many more problems than we have solved. And from this, they would go on to argue that there can really be no real progress in race relations. And it is very interesting to notice that the extreme optimists and the extreme pessimists agree on at least one point, and that is that we can sit down and do nothing in this all-important area. The extreme optimist says do nothing because integration is inevitable. The extreme pessimist says do nothing because integration is impossible. But that is a third position that can be taken, namely the realistic position. And the realist in race relations, trying to answer the question of progress, would seek to combine the truths of two opposites while avoiding the extremes of both. So the realist would agree with the optimist that we have come a long, long way, but he would seek to balance that by agreeing with the pessimist that we have a long, long way to go. And it is this realistic position that I would like to take as the basis for our thinking together this evening as we deal with the question of progress in race relations and as we deal with the whole question of the future of integration. We have come a long, long way, but we have a long, long way to go before the problem is solved. Now let us notice first that we have made meaningful strides. And I think I should point out that the Negro himself has come a long, long way in re-evaluating his own intrinsic worth. In order to illustrate this, a little history is necessary. You will remember that it was in the year 1619 when the first Negro slaves landed on the shores of this nation. They were brought here from the soils of Africa. Not like the Pilgrim Fathers who landed at Plymouth a year later, they were brought here against their wills. And throughout slavery, the Negro was treated in a very inhuman fashion. He was a thing to be used, not a person to be respected. The famous Dred Scott decision of 1857 well illustrated the status of the Negro during slavery. For in this decision, the Supreme Court of our nation said in substance that the Negro is not a citizen of the United States. He is merely property, subject to the dictates of his owner. And it went on to say that the Negro has no rights, that the white man is bound to respect. And with the growth of slavery, it became necessary to give some justification for it. It seems to be a fact of life that human beings cannot continue to do wrong without eventually reaching out for some thin rationalization to clothe an obvious truth, a wrong rather, in the beautiful garments of righteousness. And this is exactly what happened. Even religion and the Bible were misused in order to crystallize the patterns of the status quo and justify the whole system of slavery. And so it was argued by some that the Negro was inferior by nature because of Noah's curse upon the children of Ham. The Apostle Paul's dictum became a watchword, servants, be obedient to your master. And then one brother had probably read the logic of the great philosopher Aristotle. You will remember that Aristotle did a great deal to bring into being what we now know as formal logic in philosophy. And formal logic has a big word known as the syllogism, and the syllogism has a major premise, a minor premise, and a conclusion. And so this brother decided to put his argument of the inferiority of the Negro in the framework of an Aristotelian syllogism. He came out with his major premise, all men are made in the image of God. Then came his minor premise, God, as everybody knows, is not a Negro, therefore the Negro is not a man. This was the kind of reasoning that prevailed. Well, living with the system of slavery and then later segregation, many Negroes lost faith in themselves. Many came to feel that perhaps they were less than human. But then something happened to the Negro, and circumstances made it possible and necessary for him to travel more. The coming of the automobile, the upheavals of two world wars, the Great Depression. And so his rural plantation background gradually gave way to urban industrial life. Even his economic life was gradually rising through the growth of industry, the influence of organized labor, expanded educational opportunities. Even his cultural life was gradually rising through the steady decline of crippling illiteracy. All of these forces conjoined to cause the Negro to take a new look at himself. Negro masses all over began to reevaluate themselves. The Negro came to feel that he was somebody. His religion revealed to him that God loves all of his children, that all men are made in his image, and that the basic thing about a man is not his specificity, but his fundamentum, not the texture of his hair or the color of his skin, but his eternal dignity and worth. And so the Negro could now unconsciously cry out with the eloquent poet, "Fleecy locks and black complexion cannot forfeit nature's claim. Skin may differ, but affection dwells in black and white the same. Were I so tall as to reach the pole or to grasp the ocean at a span, I must be measured by my soul. The mind is the standard of the man. With this new sense of dignity and this new sense of self-respect, a new Negro came into being with a new determination to struggle, to suffer, and to sacrifice in order to be free. And so in a real sense, we've come a long, long way since 1619. But not only has the Negro himself come a long, long way in reevaluating his own intrinsic worth, we are to be true to the facts. We must say that the whole nation has come a long, long way in extending the frontiers of civil rights. And there are so many things we could point to. As one who has lived in the South all of my life, I can certainly point to this because it's so easy to see the change. 30 years ago, even 25 years ago, a year hardly passed, when numerous Negroes were not brutally lynched in the South by some vicious mob. But lynchings have about ceased today. At the turn of the century, there were very few Negroes registered to vote in the South. By 1948, that number had leaped to about 750,000. By 1960, it had leaped to 1,300,000. By 1964, it had leaped to 2,196,000. And the Supreme Court of our nation rendered a decision known as the Plessy versus Ferguson decision, which established the doctrine of separate but equal as the law of the land. Of course, we all know what happened as a result of the Plessy doctrine. There was always a strict enforcement of the separate without the slightest intention to abide by the equal. The Negro ended up being plunged into the abyss of exploitation, where he experienced the bleakness of nagging injustice. Then in 1954, the Supreme Court of our nation examined the legal body of segregation and on May 17th of that year pronounced it constitutionally dead. It said in substance that the old Plessy doctrine must go, that separate facilities are inherently unequal, and that to segregate a child on the basis of his race is to deny that child equal protection of the law. And so since that decision, we have seen many significant developments. Along with that, we've seen other legislative developments which have brought us nearer to the goal of justice. In 1964, President Johnson signed a comprehensive civil rights bill which had been so ably recommended by the late President Kennedy. And then in 1965, President Johnson signed the new Voting Rights Bill, which is now the law of the land. All of these things are significant. And so in a real sense, to put it figuratively in biblical language, we've broken loose from the Egypt of slavery. And we have moved to the wilderness of separate but equal. And now we stand on the border of the promised land of integration. And we have come a long, long way since 1896. Now this would be a wonderful place for me to bring an end to my talk tonight. First, it would mean making a short speech, and that would be a magnificent accomplishment for a Baptist preacher. But then it would mean that the problem is just about solved in America and that we really have nothing to be concerned about. We don't have much work to do. And it would be a marvelous thing if every speaker was able to talk about this problem in terms of what existed but that no longer has existence. But I'm afraid if I stop now, I will not be telling the total truth. I would be stating a fact, certainly, but not the whole truth. You see, a fact is merely the absence of contradiction, but truth is the presence of coherence. Truth is the relatedness of facts. Now, it is a fact that we've come a long, long way, but in order to get the whole truth, we've got to bring the other side into being. And if I stop at this point, I will leave you the victims of a dangerous optimism. If I stop here, I will allow us to end up with an illusion wrapped in superficiality. So in order to tell the truth, it is necessary to move on and say not only have we come a long, long way, but we have a long, long way to go all over America before the dream of brotherhood, before the ideal of integration is a reality. Now, we need not look very far to make this